This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm the co-host of this channel. Today I'm joined by another Aidan Enright, an associate researcher and part-time lecturer in history at Leeds Beckett University, where he teaches modern British history. And he's also a teacher of social sciences at the University of Bradford International College. His first book, which we're going to talk about today, is Charles Owen O'Connor, The O'Connor Don, Landlordism, Liberal Catholicism, and Unionism in 19th Century Ireland, recently published by Four Courts Press. Aidan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Aidan.
No problem. So I'm going to start by just asking, who was this person called The O'Connor Don? I suspect even a lot of people with a lot of experience in Irish history won't have heard of him, and I'll freely admit I had never heard of him. So can you tell us more about who he was and his general background?
Yeah, sure. So his name proper, if you like, was Charles Owen O'Connor, but the O'Connor Don was an old Gaelic title that he inherited from previous generations of the family. So the family was one of the old landed Catholic Gaelic sort of gentry that managed to air quotes survive the penal laws of the 18th century and come through to the 19th century as a prominent landed Catholic family in sort of the early 19th century. His background is landed. It's political. His father and his grandfather, after emancipation, were both MPs for County Roscommon. Liberal MPs for County Roscommon. He was well educated. He was educated in England, an English Catholic college called Downside near Bath in the southwest of England. So that was part of a sort of a tradition amongst the landed Catholic elite and middle classes in sort of the early 19th through to the middle and late 19th century, where they an English Catholic education was perceived to be the sort of the best education that a young Irish Catholic gentleman could get. So landed, political, educated, well educated, well traveled. Once he finished his education in the 1850s, mid 1850s, mid to late 1850s, he went on a tour of Europe, France, Italy. Present-day Germany, was a chamberlain to the Pope, was sort of another one of those sort of typical things that a young Irish Catholic gentleman would do upon a visit to Rome. A very well-to-do, well-educated, well-travelled young Irish Catholic gentleman who then went on to inherit his father's estates, about 7,500 acres when he came of age in 1859, and inherited his father's seat. He became the Liberal MP for County Roscommon in 1860, a year later, after he inherited the estates. But crucially, he also inherited £50,000 from a cousin called Edward Moore. And that was crucial, really, to the expansion of the O'Connor estates in the sort of late 1850s, early 1860s, to the tune of about 5,000 acres. So, you know, £50,000 in today's change is, I don't know, something like three or four million quid, you know, so quite a substantial amount of money for anyone to inherit. But it was crucial, if you like, in terms of giving him the sort of the security of you know, sort of wealth and prestige, and also in terms of his role as a landlord, it sort of enabled him to go easy, if you like, on the collection of rent and arrears, because he had that sort of cushion. Now, who's to say, you know, that he wouldn't have been that kind of landlord anyway. The family had a tradition of good relationship with their tenants. So it may have been that he would have been that type of landlord without the extra £50,000, because he was already a well-to-do man anyway. So that's it, really. I hope that gives you, like, you know, he was part of a sort of a liberal Catholic tradition, if you like, following on from the sort of O'Connellite period of a sort of moderate, liberal-minded, you know, gradualist reform kind of politics that shunned away from the sort of the more radical elements of nationalist politics in the sort of mid to late 19th century, and was, you know, part of a sort of a you know, the sort of landed and political elite of Ireland and Great Britain at that time, even though he was Catholic. You know, by the time he came along, there was a significant minority of landed, well-to-do, well-educated Catholics who were part of, essentially, of the British-Irish establishment, and quite comfortably so.
So as I was starting to read your book, I mean, I'm obviously reading it as someone whose background is much more in late 19th and early 20th century Irish history. And I thought, okay, I can tell what this person is, right? He's Catholic, he's a liberal, and he's of this, like, very old Gaelic stock. So I assume, okay, this guy's a nationalist, and yet he's not. So what is he politically?
Well, politically, he's a liberal, you know, first and foremost. But he's a liberal Catholic, and that's, you know, the crucial thing to consider in terms of this idea of a liberal Catholic, an Irish liberal Catholic, you know, because you mention it to a lot of people and they sort of look at you sideways and kind of go, what, a liberal and a Catholic? But, you know, in terms of the 19th century, what it meant to be a liberal is very different to what it means to be a liberal these days. So, you know, if you're a liberal and you're a Catholic and you're a devout Catholic, or even if you're a liberal and you're a Protestant and you're a devout Protestant, you know, your devout religious faith tempers your political outlook, if you like. So for a liberal Catholic like the O'Connor Don, his sort of liberalism was sort of inflected with a kind of a conservative Catholicism that was very much, if you like, sort of trying to advocate, you know, free, you know, religious equality and religious freedom for Catholics. And in 19th century Ireland, that meant, and certainly from the mid 19th century onwards, with the sort of the rise of the Catholic Church again, and the power of the Catholic Church in Irish society under Cardinal Cullen, particularly, that meant, you know, for freedom of religion, Catholic education in particular was a big issue. So his notion of what it meant to be a liberal as a Catholic was that Catholics ought to have the freedom to educate themselves as they saw fit. And that meant a Catholic education as opposed to a secular education. And that was the big debate in terms of what it meant to be a liberal in the 19th century. So on the one hand, a liberal Catholic that, like the O'Connor Don, supported what he saw as religious freedom, and religious freedom to him meant the freedom to provide a Catholic education for Catholic people. But for other liberal Catholics and liberal Protestants, it meant a secular education. So Catholics and Protestants being educated together to create a more sort of integrated society, if you like, and to sort of tackle the old sort of religious divides. So it was two, essentially two different interpretations of what it meant to be a liberal. So I'm not sure. That's probably a very long-winded explanation of what it meant to be a liberal Catholic in the 19th century.
There's another thing you say early on in the book that kind of, I think, again, shows how these words can shift their meaning, where you say that he was actually opposed to majoritarian democracy, which you would think today is like the most basic thing that you need to believe in to be a liberal. So so what does he view of say, mass politics or working class people getting involved in politics, things like that?
So again, it's I think you know, but there's a tendency to sort of to look back through history, if you like, and think about what it meant to be a liberal in the context of how we understand it today. But in the 19th century, many liberals, whether Catholic or Protestant, were quite wary about the advance of democratic politics. Right up to the end of the 19th century, you know, many of them still came from the sort of the old landed elite, the well-educated sort of middle to upper classes, the professions. You know, they had jobs in education, the civil service, the empire, politics, the professions. So they were quite wary of the sort of the rise of democratic politics, and the Iconodone sort of fits into that. That mold. Like, he wasn't opposed to the expansion of the franchise, but he was wary of it, of sort of, you know, a full-throated democracy, if you like, that that politics and political reform ought to be guided by well-educated men such as himself, who could guide the sort of popular will in the sort of right direction, if you like, to maintain the security of the state, basically, and you know, law and order. So, you know, quite wary about this idea of mass participatory democratic politics, but not opposed to the gradual reform of the franchise and the expansion of the franchise, if that makes any sense.
Sure. I mean, in some ways that's kind of continuing a tradition that goes back to O'Connell, at least, about a certain kind of wariness of where politics can go if everyone gets to vote. Does he share O'Connell's view that Ireland should have its own parliament? Like, is he a nationalist in that sense, or is he more of a unionist?
So I argue in the book that he's essentially a unionist. Now, he would have saw himself as an Irish patriot. And, you know, he supported, for instance, the preservation of the Irish language. And now, he didn't get massively involved in the Gaelic League. He didn't get involved in the Gaelic League at all, actually. But in the early manifestations of that movement, the Society for the Preservation of the Irish Language and the Gaelic Union, he was sort of involved from a distance. And he pushed for legislative reform in Parliament to include the Irish language in the intermediate and university education curriculums. So we had this sort of a cultural, if you like, nationalism, if you like, but in the sort of classic political sense, you just couldn't argue he was a nationalist, because he was opposed to Home Rule, even though he thought that Home Rule would eventually have to happen. He was actually opposed to any sort of practical proposals he opposed Gladstone's two Home Rule bills, for example. He was opposed to any practical proposals for it in his time, because he was wary of the popular, often violent tendencies, radical tendencies within Irish nationalism. You know, the sort of the new departure of Parnell, the Land League, attacks on landlords, disruption of law and order. He was absolutely appalled by all that. So he just didn't trust Parnell and the Irish Parliamentary Party. And he, you know, that's how he lost the seat in 1880. So, to get back to your question, which was he a nationalist? I think was that what you asked me? I think.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say no, he wasn't in the classic political sense. But that's not to say that he didn't see himself as an Irish patriot. He wasn't proud to be Irish, and he had a very strong sense of Irish identity, and he had a sort of a broader, if you like, sort of cultural nationalist outlook. But in the strict political sense, he was part of a landed and political elite who were unionist, and he made the case against Home Rule. He associated with unionist politicians. He went to unionist meetings. He, you know, and he opposed Home Rule. He was a loyalist as well. He supported the Empire. He was the bearer of the Irish Standard at King Edward the VII's coronation in 1902. So everything about him in the sort of his social milieu and his political outlook and his political arguments and his political positions was unionist. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that he wasn't an Irish patriot, had some sense of Irish, you know, support for Irish nationhood, if you like, and that sort of broader cultural sort of nationalist feeling.
So I think, I mean, what you're saying here, and I think what the book does too, is to show how we have to be very careful with how these words can shift their meaning in sometimes subtle ways, sometimes quite non-subtle ways over time. And there's something that Kieran O'Neill says in the introduction to your book, or in the kind of preface that he wrote, that he feels that the O'Connor Don's sense of multiple identities and how you can be both a patriot and a unionist at the same time bears comparison to the complexities of Northern Ireland today. And I was wondering if you would make a similar claim, and this is a bit of a polemical question maybe, that his status as a landlord politician could be compared to politics in the Republic of Ireland today, or is that something very different?
Well, gosh, that's a tricky one. I think so, in the sense that many of the Irish political elite in the Republic of Ireland are well-educated young, you know. So I guess the likes of Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar, for instance, you know, educated in the sort of elite Catholic colleges of, you know, not, I guess, nominally Catholic in these days, I don't know really, but, you know, BlackRock or whatever the equivalent is in Cork, I'm not quite sure what the names of these colleges are, but, you know, they received a similar kind of education, and, you know, they're seeing, you know, that sort of path in life, sort of elite college education, on to university, is seen as the sort of pathway towards politics, if you're interested in politics and political power. So in that sort of sense, I guess there's a political establishment in Ireland today that you could sort of make maybe perhaps a tenuous connection to the political establishment in the O'Connor Don's time, in the sense they follow a similar trajectory along educational lines. I think the other part of your question was, you know, this argument that you can be a unionist and a patriot. And Northern Irish politics today, was that what you were?
Yeah, sure. What Kieran O'Neill says in the preface that he wrote for your book.
Yeah. Well, I think, I guess, I would echo that in the sense that, you know, the complexity of the O'Connor Don's politics and identity, can be seen in the politics and culture and identity in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. You know, so many unionists would say that they are proud Irish men and women, you know, and see themselves as patriots in that sense, but that they also have a sort of a British, you know, they have a strong British identity as well, and they don't see any sort of conflict between the two. Now, I think I don't know if you've ever seen the Ali G interview with Sammy Wilson, where Sammy Wilson keeps saying that he's British and he refuses to say that he's Irish. So I think you're always going to get people on the extreme ends, I guess, of politics and culture who will take a very staunch position one way or the other. But I think many unionists will be quite clear in the sense that they see themselves as Irish and British. And, you know, the O'Connor Don certainly had a strong Irish identity, but he was certainly very attached to a broader British culture and identity. You know, he married an English Catholic. He was educated in England. Now, that's not to say that everybody who, you know, so there was many young Irish Catholic gentlemen who were educated in English Catholic colleges and went on to be staunch Republicans. Thomas Francis Meagher is one example. So there's not a straight line, if you like, between that kind of background and culture. But the O'Connor Don was definitely on the unionist side, but with a very strong sense of Irishness and Irish patriotism.
So maybe
that is reflected in today's politics, certainly in Northern Ireland.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So maybe rather than trying to back you into making a connection to sort of contemporary politics, what do you think he reveals about social class in his own time?
Right. Okay. Well, I guess what it reveals is that there was, you know, that there was a very, very strong sense of social class amongst the landed elite. You know, I sort of say in the book that he was a man out of time by the end of the 19th century. You know, he was very much a man of the landed gentry, who had a strong sense that men of his stature and ilk and education and broader sort of cultural outlook were the kind of people who should be the leaders of the country, and that the uneducated and the broader sort of population, you know, were to be, you know, whether, you know, working class or laboring class or tenant class or whatever way you would describe it in the 19th century, obviously mostly tenant farmer, laboring class, were to be feared in a sense. And that, you know, that radicalism, Fenianism, mass democratic politics was to be guarded against and protected against by a landed and political elite. So he had a very strong sense of who he was in class terms, although he didn't really speak about it in those terms. He spoke a lot about, you know, nationalist agitators and Fenianism, but men like him didn't seem to have a very strong sense of class in the sense, maybe in the way that we would these days.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't speak about it in those terms, but they certainly had a strong sense of who they were themselves and what role they had in society.
Mm-hmm, of course. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could go back to this inheritance that he gets that is kind of what copper fastens his kind of standing in life, or at least like his financial comfort.
Yeah.
Some of that money comes from the slave trade. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, yeah. So his cousin Edward Moore was a landowner in the West Indies and Australia. And he owned slaves in the West Indies. And he was compensated for that when slavery was abolished. In 1833, wasn't it? Yes, is that right? Yes, I think. So he died unmarried and without any children. So he left £50,000 to the O'Connor Don and the O'Connor Don's brother Dennis, and their cousin Valentine O'Connor Blake, who owned estates in Mayo and County Mayo and County Galway. I sort of write about that a little in the book. I don't go into too much detail, I guess, because I just didn't have the sort of the evidence or the research to to get into too much detail on that. But certainly, I think it would be difficult to imagine that he wasn't aware of the provenance of that money. And I think it's sort of, you know, he was an imperialist. He supported the British imperial project. But his views on the slavery issue are not clear. He did visit America in the 1860s, so just after at the end of the Civil War. And he comments on attitudes towards slavery. He met former slave owners. He went to Washington. He sort of spoke about how people who were opposed to slavery were saying, well, you know, these slaves are not going to do with their, they're not going to know what to do with their freedom, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he didn't express a view in his diaries one way or the other, certainly that I was able to discover, as to whether he was on the Union or Confederate side. He met Robert E. Lee, and sort of mentioned how he was seen as a leader of his people and all the rest of it, and a fine looking man and all the rest of it. But he doesn't really, he's cagey in his diaries, or, you know, at least he doesn't say explicitly one way or the other what his position was. But maybe that's indicative of a sort of an indifference. I don't know. It's hard to say. I think it would be fair to say one way or the other, you know, but on, you know, because he doesn't actually explicitly say one way or the other.
So I know that this book kind of has a long history and comes out of your PhD dissertation, and then took some time to sort of see the light of day as an actual published book. So do you have plans to continue on to something new, or where will you go next as a historian?
So I finished my PhD in 2011, and then I went off and did other things. Got a bit fed up with it, to be honest, and sort of, you know, precarious work and all the rest of it, and ended up working in politics, actually, believe it. But anyway, where am I going next? I'm back working, back teaching at Leeds Beckett University. I'm looking to. I would like to build on this research to some extent. So I've looked at the connections between Irish and English Catholics in the 19th century, and the sort of intermarriage between, you know, sort of landed English and Irish Catholics, and particularly interested in one individual, a Charles Riley Chichester, who married an Irish Catholic and settled in Ireland and ran an estate in County Roscommon. I came across him through the O'Connor Dunn, basically, because they corresponded with each other on land reform. So I'm interested in that sort of wider network of Irish and English Catholics from emancipation onwards. But I'm also interested in the Irish in Britain as well, and how they influenced politics in Britain. So to give you an example, I'm going to be giving a paper next year on William Forster, who was Chief Secretary for Ireland between 1880 and 1882. He was a Liberal MP for Bradford, which is where I live now and have been living for the last 10 years. So I'm interested in how he interacted with the Bradford Irish community, which was sizable at that point. And, you know, particularly his role as Chief Secretary. And, you know, he was known as Buckshot Forster. You know, he was seen as taking a very draconian approach to law and order in Ireland at the time, and his position on home rule and things like that, and how that affected politics in Bradford amongst the Irish community. So I'm sort of branching out in that direction a bit more, away from the sort of landed Catholic elite politics. I'm getting a bit more interested in the sort of more working class, middle class Irish Catholic community and how they influenced politics in Britain, particularly in Bradford.
Well, if this book is anything to go by, that'll obviously be some really excellent research. And thank you so much for this great conversation.
No problem. And I'd just like to say that obviously the book on the O'Connor Dunn is available in all good bookshops, and available to buy on Four Courts website, fourcourtspress.ie. So if anybody out there in the ether is interested in finding out more about the O'Connor Dunn, that's probably the easiest place to go.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Aidan.
Cheers. Thanks a million, Aidan.